Welcome to BizRocket Radio with Stone Payton and John Baker. John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. And now, get ready for BizRocket Radio. Here's Stone Payton and John Baker.
Welcome to BizRocket Radio. This is John Baker, and we are here in the office in Alpharetta with three guests that we're really excited to talk to, and we're happy that they actually made it through the traffic this morning. If you're heading north on 400, be aware, there's traffic. There's an accident in this rainy day, and like most things that happen in Atlanta, the traffic stands still when the rain comes. At least it's not ice yet, so at least we got that going for us. BizRocket Radio is a show that we get an opportunity to speak with and learn from executives in the Atlanta area, learn from their experiences, the challenges that they've had, the successes that they've had. And we have three individuals in today that we're going to learn a ton of information from. Our first guest is Jim Rogers, and Jim is an author. His most recent book, Managing Differently, is something that we may get into a little bit. But he's also the president and CEO of The Diversity Coach. So, Jim, welcome in.
Thank you, John. Thank you. It's good to be here.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit about The Diversity Coach and your background a little bit.
Well, I like to get the important things out first. I'm married, been married to the same woman all my life. I have 5 children, 7 grandchildren.
Holy mackerel.
Hey, well, you know, it's a good start.
I got 4 and I'm challenged, man. I am like going 100 miles an hour
yeah,
right now.
I think I tell people all the time, 5 is a good start. by background, I'm a double E, electrical engineer and an MBA. And I've been in private practice for a little over 24 years. Prior to that, I was with the Bell System. I was a fast-rising executive in the old Bell System with AT&T and Bell South. And then felt the calling to do my own thing, and so that's why I got into management consulting. And the Diversity Coach is an outgrowth of what my clients insisted that I do. It was not my first choice. I started in the quality movement, moved into career coaching, and because of the need for many of our clients to understand the emerging demographics and psychographics that were emerging in both the employees and in the marketplace, they insisted that I add my voice to that. And so that's what I've been doing.
So tell us about diversity management. When we hear that, sometimes we think of you know, hiring the right number of people that are certain individuals and that kind of thing. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what you mean by diversity management.
Well, people, first of all, you have to define what diversity is. Diversity is nothing more than the differences and the similarities that all humankind brings to the table. Now, naturally, our thinking sometimes goes to race, gender, and what we call the visible dimensions of diversity. But the more relevant portions of diversity is diversity of thought, diversity of perspective. See, it's the different perspectives that bring value to any conversation. So when you're on a team, you want to make sure that not everyone thinks the same way.
Right.
Otherwise, they'd be redundant.
That's right.
So the whole idea is to make sure that you have a variety of different perspectives at the table so that we're all looking at the same problem, but we're looking at it differently so that we add value to how we're analyzing it. Diversity management is nothing more than managing the diversity that you've already got.
Yeah.
So the objective of diversity management is not to get diversity. It is to acknowledge that we've already got plenty of different perspectives. We're just not using them very well. And so that's what the whole gist of that is all about.
So natural perspective is diversity just occurs. Just the natural tendency is that it's going to occur. You're helping managers or executives handle the different characteristics and the types of people that are on their team already.
Absolutely. First of all, by just getting them to acknowledge that there are different perspectives at the table, because sometimes we tend to look around the room and we say, well, we all kind of alike, and we... And in fact, quite often businesses get into the mode where they really want people who think alike. That makes decision making easy.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it very effective, but it certainly makes it easy. You can can come to a very fast conclusion when everybody at the table is thinking the same thing.
Right.
But what we're finding in an age where innovation is so critical to business success, you don't get very much innovation when you've got everybody at the table thinking the same thing. Yeah. So it's really critical for you to deliberately, and that's what we talk about, deliberate diversity, to deliberately have different perspectives at the table so that you consider all possibilities.
So I would imagine a lot of this has to start off really at the hiring phase. I mean, it happens naturally, but wouldn't you want to control the kind of diversity that you have at the table?
Yeah, and then it takes some sophistication to do that, because the natural tendency when you think of diversity is to make sure that we've got people of color and women and gay and lesbian people and all those different types of what we call internal dimensions of diversity.
Yep.
It takes a little more work to really figure out that you may be from the Northeast and you went to a different college that I went to, and you're from a single-parent family, and I'm from a dual-parent family, and you were raised Catholic, and I was raised Buddhist. Those things matter in how I see the world.
Mm.
So it takes a little work for you, for me to figure out, do I really have diversity at the table? Because guess what? I'm an engineer by training, and a lot of the people that I work with come out of the engineering discipline. We pretty much think alike.
Yeah.
I'm black, they're white, but that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell me anything about the diversity at the table by just looking at the visible.
Right.
So it takes the work to try to figure out what do you bring to the table? What perspective do you offer that will give us a better solution than we could get without you?
This is a really fascinating topic as a business owner and managing people for decades. It's almost this underlying silence, and so hard to figure out sometimes who people are, and what they bring to the table. It's, you see somebody, unless you really delve deeper into kind of what they're all about, you really don't know. So how do you do that?
Well, you do just what you just said. You have to actually have to have the conversation. I was in a session yesterday with a bunch of other diversity managers, and we had this question. For instance, politics and religion are considered taboo subjects at the workplace.
Yeah.
And what I'm suggesting to people is, in order to get to know a person deeply, you need to know all about them. And that means having that conversation and controlling that conversation in such a way that you're seeking understanding and not to persuade or coerce or convince or influence.
Right, right.
And if you can ever get to that level of sophistication with people, you can understand a little bit more about them. You'll understand why they see the world the way that they do, why you see the world the way that you do, and you begin to understand and appreciate there's real value here.
Hmm.
When I talk to John, I can expect that he's not going to see it the way that I see it, so he's going to add some value to my way of thinking about it. So it really is a deliberate effort on the part of leaders and executives to say, I want to know more about you.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know where you are. I'm not going to judge it. I'm not here to influence you or create. I just want to know so that I understand that when I'm putting a team together to make a quality decision, I want to make sure you're there, because you will see it differently than I do.
So the politics and religion as being the maybe the two, that's for the master's degree, right? That's
right.
Your doctorate's degree. Get in that conversation.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more of the bachelor's or maybe associate's degree. What kind of conversations might help break the ice or learn a little bit more about what that person's all about?
Well, it's really all about the questions that you ask. And just by asking someone, tell me a little bit about yourself, and going beyond the cursory that we always do, because I tell people all the time, we work with people 20 years and you really don't know them.
You
know their business perspective, you know what they do, you know the kind of, you know, cursory conversations you have at the water cooler, but you don't really know who they are. So are you married or you're not married? And in this, in these days and times, it's becoming more prevalent for people to kind of open up, as I say, open up the kimono and say, kind of, here's who I am. This is what you get when you get me.
Right, right.
And in the interview questions, we're finding that people are starting to do that more. You know, rather than all these standard questions, they're starting to say, you know, back away. Let's tell me a little bit about you. You know, what do you think about this? What do you think about that?
Right.
And be honest with me. Be authentic with me. Be genuine with me. Tell me, you know, where you're coming. This is not a qualifying question. This is just so I get to know you.
Right.
And to understand whether or not you fit in our organization.
Do employees take a second look almost when you do that? Because they're almost like, you know, why are you asking me those questions? That's not even used to that.
Yeah. Especially when I talk to managers, and a lot of my practice, if you look at my book, is about helping managers of people to do that job more effectively. And the worst thing that can happen is a manager gets enlightened and comes back and start asking questions like that. And the immediate response on the part of the employee is, oh, he's been to one of those management programs.
Now he wants to get to know me.
So you have to be consistent in that. You have to come to say, well, I'm asking you this time, and, you know, maybe you're not comfortable answering, but I'm going to ask you again tomorrow. Yeah. Because I really want to know. So you really have to set the tone and the environment where the person really finally figures out, you know something, he's genuinely interested in who I am. And I think I'll tell him. So it doesn't just happen overnight. You're very wise to pick up on that that's a little suspicious sometimes unless you're consistent with it.
Right. And all of a sudden just jump off the cliff, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So do you led the conversation. You led today with who you were, and you had 5 kids married. Yeah. Obviously, your wife is listening, and she says she's going to give you perks on the way.
Absolutely.
Maybe grandkids also.
Yeah.
Grandkids, a whole nine yards. Do you find that when you get into those kinds of relationships at work, or you're trying to build that kind of a team, that kind of road goes both ways on that?
Ask that again.
Are you sharing as much about yourself as you are asking your employees to share about them?
Yeah, absolutely. In order to get other people to open up, you have to open up. Mm-hmm. This is just fundamental human nature. You know, if you come in with your kimono clothes, I guarantee you they're going to close theirs because they figure out culturally it is not okay for me to be fully who I am here. Mm-hmm. So you have to demonstrate that and model that behavior if you're in the leadership or management role and let people know, here's kind of who I am. Probably telling you more than you want to know about me, but I think it's important that you know so that when we're working together as a team, you'll understand where I'm coming from. I may be right, as Monk always says. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. you know, I may not be right all the time, but at least you'll understand what's driving my opinion about certain things.
What managers or what companies are ready for this kind of training that you've found? And there's some that just aren't. They're not ready for that.
Yeah.
When are they ready?
Boy, I wish I knew the answer to that. I've been doing this work for 20 years. Yeah. And I tell you, the problem is that people get so hung up on visible diversity that it's hard to get it out of their heads.
Mm-hmm.
So when people hear the word diversity, they get locked into, or what I call get stuck into, this mode of thinking, we got to get more women, we got to get more people of color, we need more Asians, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And it's a tough sell sometimes to get people to think in a more sophisticated way about it.
Yeah.
When they do, and I do have a handful of clients who are moving in that direction, when they do, they begin to demonstrate the efficacy of true diversity management. And they're looking to see, when I have Jim and John at the table, we get better results. Our decisions are higher quality. We create more innovative ideas. Let's experiment with that more and more throughout the company so that we can get more of those types of outcome. I'm focusing them on getting better business outcomes as a result of using the different perspectives that they have available to them already in their enterprise. Mm-hmm. And that's just a handful. Part of my experience and background in this work is in the early days, I happened to be the chief advisor to a lot of the senior teams of companies that had major lawsuits. There are a couple of companies here in town that you may remember that went through that. And so I advised Coca-Cola and Georgia Power and Southern Company and Lockheed and a bunch of those folks. And unfortunately, events like that kind of get people locked into, this is what it's got to be about.
Right.
But some of those companies are beginning to move beyond that and say, you know, that ain't really the issue.
Yeah.
Because the color of your skin doesn't tell me anything about how you see the world.
Yeah.
It just tells me what I see. It doesn't tell me anything about you.
It's so much easier to make generalization, stereotypes, and window dressing.
Absolutely.
But it's so much harder to go down there and figure out who those people are all about.
Yeah. And you know something, John, I'm sure you can attest to this. People appreciate you showing interest in who they really are. Mm. And that's what I'm saying. As a manager, you have to model it and you have to be consistent with it. But after a while, you'll find that you can really coalesce a team by just letting people know, I'm genuinely interested in who you are.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to assume that because you look the way that you do, that you think the way that I think people who look like you think.
Right.
I'm going to actually ask you, what do you think about it?
That's right.
And it's something very powerful about that level of engagement with people that I have found in my work as with managers and leaders has really paid dividends for the people who lead organizations.
So is that your primary clientele? Is it the small organizations or the larger ones and the managers within there? Who's your clientele?
Well, I work with over 200 different organizations, and they range from the BMS like Johnson & Johnson and Southern Company all the way down to mid-sized companies like medical centers, all the way down to small businesses, mm-hmm. all of whom have issues around what I call human capital issues. And, of course, I tell people all the time, if you've got people working there, I can help you. Everybody likes to say, you know, well, it's different here. You know,
right.
Our culture is different.
Right.
You know, you got human beings there?
Yeah.
I think we can talk, you know. So it's really I have worked with the companies that I talked about, and I work with a lot of other mid-sized companies. But my objective always is to help the leaders to understand how to get the best from all of their people all of the time. There are a lot of things that get in the way, the assumptions that we make, that get in the way of us getting the best from all of our people. Sometimes we look at a person and we say, well, he looks just like the last superstar that I had.
Yeah.
So I'm going to assume he's a superstar.
It's so easy to do that.
It does, yeah.
It's so easy. Even when you go and you really learn about people and you understand
mm-hmm.
that's not that person,
yeah.
But it's so easy to go there.
Part of this whole work is around readjusting our thinking patterns. And, you know, I do a lot of work in brain mechanics because the brain, it really is a fabulous tool. But, boy, it can trip you up sometimes. You
yeah.
know, just the medulla back here stores a bunch of stereotypes. And if you're not careful, if you're not aware or awake, those stereotypes will kick in the minute you see someone, and you've already formed an opinion about them before they've even said one word to you.
Yeah.
And so we have to be sophisticated enough to understand that that's how we operate as human beings, and we have to develop skills to move beyond that.
So let's say that I hired you and we engaged your services. What would be the first step? What would be the experience that we'd go through with
you? Yeah. One of the things that I do, even in my private coaching with executives and with my consulting work with major interventions and with the type of training that I do, one of the things that I do up front is to determine if change is indicated, are you interested in change? Are you willing to change? And are you able to change? So one of the mm-hmm. things that I do in coaching, and this applies at every level of an intervention, is I ask a person, what is your core personality? Because I want you to know that the change that you're expecting to make is either going to be easy or hard for you. And you have to decide, do I want to make that change? Am I willing to make it? And am I able to make it? The most frustrating thing that any management consultant can run into is a person who says they want to change. You go through the process of assessing, visioning, and learning, and you find out at the end of it that they didn't really want to change.
Yeah.
And so I try to determine that up front. A lot of the organizations, some of the big projects that I've had have come out of pain, like the lawsuits that I talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they have motivation to change. But even they didn't want to change. They wanted to get past the current pain.
Yeah, and back to the normal.
Yeah,
right?
And then what I say, we all tend to lapse back to natural. So until we have really sustainable motivation to move beyond where we are, it's not likely that humankind is really just going to embrace change. So that's the biggest challenge.
And what you're referring to, are those the four quadrants that you discuss or talk about in your business?
Well, I've been struggling for years to try to present deliberate diversity in a way that I think executives and leaders will understand it. And so one of the things that I've come up with is if you think of a 2x2 grid, on one side you're looking at the level of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Relevant diversity,
mm-hmm.
not visible diversity. And on the other side, you're looking at levels of management skills. There turn out to be four quadrants. The highest quadrant, where you've got a lot of diversity but low management skill, means you get low performance. That really surprises a lot of people because everybody is working hard to get more diversity, and they don't realize that diversity reduces your productivity when it's not managed well.
Yeah, it's like a gun, right?
It really is. Right? It really is. It becomes one of those silent saboteurs. Mm-hmm. Down in the next quadrant two, where you've really got low diversity and low management skills, you can get moderate levels of performance there because, again, everybody's at the table. We make decisions quick. We all kind of know where we're going.
Right.
And you move over to the third quadrant where you are increasing your management skills, but you're low on diversity. Guess what? You can get high performance there for the same reasons that I just talked about. But you only get peak performance when you move to a place where you've got high diversity and high management skills. That means that I've really learned how to get to know the people, know what their strengths and skills are, put the right people at the table, and then facilitate them through a conversation and drive them to consensus so that I actually get the best possible decision and the most innovation that I can produce out of this team of people. Mm-hmm. So the thing about it is, and what deliberate diversity says, is that there are some times when you don't want to go there.
Yeah.
You don't want to really drive towards peak performance using diversity when you've got a simple decision to make. Sometimes it's worth it. Sometimes it's not worth it. So I'm just asking people to be a little bit more deliberate and sophisticated about making decisions. Don't go out and get diversity just for diversity's sake. It's not going to serve you. Get it for the purpose of we want to be a world-class leader. And we know that there are certain times that we need innovation. We need quality decision-making. We need prediction. We need all of these things that are going to move us ahead of our competition. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that we have the available diversity at the table so we can make those things.
Perfect. Perfect. So in wrapping up, one of the questions I like to ask all my guests is to get a pearl of wisdom from you, from your experience and the things that you've done in the past. What would your pearl of wisdom be to our listeners?
It's basically the same. I'm a spiritual teacher as well as a management consultant and diversity coach. And it is for all people to slow down, pay attention, because sometimes we're so busy doing what we're doing, we can't remember why we're doing it. Mm-hmm. And so I say that to executives all the time. I'm writing a second book now with a colleague called E is for Enterprise, Simplifying the Business Conversation. The whole idea there is that we've gotten to the place where, in order to hide the fact that we don't know what we're talking about, we use obscure and proprietary language. It's like, it's an engineering thing. You wouldn't understand. You know? The fact is, I don't understand.
I should
be able to explain it to you.
Right.
So it's really, my pearl of wisdom is for people to slow down, back away, pay attention to what's going on, keep it simple, and remember that there's a reason that you're doing what you're doing. You need to go back and get that.
Okay. So, Jim, if somebody wanted to get in contact with you, what's the best way to reach out?
I can be reached at my office at 770-482-9452 and on the web at www.thediversitycoach.com. And my email, of course, is jora@thediversitycoach.com.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jim, for coming on and taking your time this morning. You going to be able to hang out for a minute?
Oh, well, sure.
Okay.
Looking forward to the conversation.
So our next guest is Jim Vilwalk.
That's correct.
And Jim is the founder and CEO of Job Doctors International.
That's right.
So welcome in, Jim.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit of background on kind of how you got here and what you're doing now.
Okay. Well, my background is corporate America. So I went in Fortune 500s, and we made a lot of entrepreneur changes. Created brand new businesses from scratch, reorganized and created a virtual global supply management organization. All new paradigms. So I enjoy looking at business, looking how it could be done simpler and better with major results. And so when I left corporate America, I started forming other companies. One was from a Dutch company. I set up the U.S. subsidiary. I formed three of my own companies. Looking around then at my peers, which were C-level executives, I realized, boy, they really don't know how to communicate to other people well, develop relationships, don't know how to network, don't know how to get a job if they're out of a job. And my suspicion was, even when they're in the job, most of them really didn't know how to develop their career, mm-hmm. because they were very tunnel vision and focused on their specific task.
Right.
And so that's why I said, you know what, this sounds like fun. Let me get into this new area and see what I can do to create new thoughts, new paradigms on how people can actually be effective in three areas: leadership, organization, and employee.
So tell us about your integrated success. How does that come into play, and how do you use that as a tool?
What we did was we looked at those same three legs of the stool. Leadership, where most C-level executives are outward-focused introverts, and they don't communicate well internally. So they're going to the left, the organization is still going straight. We then looked at the organization. Are they hiring right, putting people in the right seat? Are they all aligned to following the corporate strategy, particularly when it changes to the left? We then looked at the employee. Are the employees really being mentored? Most companies have no clue how to mentor properly. And they don't have time either. So it's a double-edged sword.
Right.
Do the employees really know how to have a roadmap, how they can develop their own career? And if they find themselves in transition, can they use those same skills to continue to hone, to learn how to fish for a job or a promotion?
Mm-hmm. And how do you, when you go into an organization and you're implementing this, are you starting from the top, or are you doing it in a kind of a reverse fashion where you're working with the employees first and then going up?
We look primarily as a thought leader of training management consultants, HR consultants, coaches, so that we give them the tools and the resources they can add to their current existing knowledge with these resources to help their clients. From our perspective, when we go and see a client, and we have a lot of friends who want us to come in, we usually prefer to start at the C-level. But we also know that very often they say, that's a great idea. Why don't you start down there with them?
Yeah.
And so they don't want the risk of being exposed. I understand that. And so we actually normally then provide whatever they want, strategic or tactical, so they have choices that are politically appropriate for that organization.
Mm-hmm.
The larger, the more tactical they want to be.
So you're starting at the top and you're kind of working your way down.
We prefer to, but mm-hmm. we normally start up there, and they often say, go look down.
Yep.
They'll refer us to HR, or refer us to an area where they have an issue.
Yep.
And they want some assistance.
Yep.
But we prefer to work with those individuals who are already in those clients, providing a service, and we're simply adding a new dimension that makes them more effective and more value-add.
So in talking about helping develop organizations, kind of people talent almost, it almost sounds like it's you're helping corporations developing their people talent, and you're also helping the individuals learn how to grow and develop, whether they're in that organization or not. It sounds like it's kind of a double benefit to the organization, to the people as well.
Well, it's a triple benefit because, again, the leadership. The first rule we tell anybody in the organization is learn the business. And most people don't even know what that means because they've never had to. But how can you do your job and help the business, add value to the business, if you don't understand the business that you're in?
Mm-hmm.
So we really prefer to start there if we can.
Mm-hmm.
The second area is in the organization. It's not so much career skill development. A lot of people do that. The missing link is that very often when you hire people or promote people or get rid of people, you don't really know who they are. And so we partner with a best of breed assessment, which is a true behavioral assessment as mm-hmm. opposed to personality, that measures three things. And you can see why these are so important. Number one, it measures, are you interested in company success or your own personal promotion? And two errors, one would be you're Machiavellian. You like to create issues, point blame on everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're so rigid, you like to micromanage, high pressure, and you like to make sure that you're doing it my way or the highway.
Okay, I got a question on that. I'm going to take a... So one of the measurements is going to the individual and saying, are you more interested in the success of the organization or of you? Do you get a lot of people that are more interested about the success of the company versus their own success?
My experience has been about 60-40.
60, so 60 myself and 40 company?
No, reverse.
Reverse, really?
60% really are wanting to help the company. They believe their success is by helping the company be successful.
Okay.
However, it only takes one person who is all about themselves right. to create all kinds of havoc. And most companies have already hired a lot of people, and those are the ones who create dysfunction in most organizations, which lowers productivity
yep.
and causes all kinds of inward-focused mm-hmm. as opposed to company success outward-focused.
Yep.
So that's the first measurement.
Okay.
And we believe that that is a yellow light. Boy, if you see that, if they're dysfunctional, doesn't mean don't hire them.
Okay.
You have to look at the total picture. If they have a golden Rolodex, it may be worth the price.
Just keep a close eye on them, right?
Just, yeah, it's harder to manage.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're unmanageable.
Right.
The second is, what role do they really fit in the company? You can design entire company with different roles. There are 10 major behavioral roles. But, for example, the C-suite, there are usually only three roles that really fit in the C-suite.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not one of those three, innately, it's going to be very difficult to get up into the high levels. You can learn a lot of behaviors to compensate. But the real superstars, they both have the innate and the learn. No different than in sports or other activities.
Right.
So the third, then, is, are you a team player? So if you are not aligned with company success, you're not a team player, and you're in the wrong role, then there's huge areas of opportunity for improvement.
Yeah. So working with all these companies and organizations, what are the top problems or mistakes that you see companies just making over and over? You're like, ah, here it goes again. You know, this happens all the time.
The first is they don't think about the strategy of hiring right, putting people in the right seat, going and aligning them in the right direction. Most senior executives, in my observation, including my companies, are so focused on getting more revenue and driving the business and driving growth and responding to the tyranny of the urgent from the outside that they assume the internal organizations will fix the internal problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really don't take time, don't have time
right.
to focus on it. So the challenge is most of those internal organizations are tactical.
Yeah.
They're responding to the tyranny of the urgent for day-to-day tactical operations, which means there's a huge gap. And so that's the first problem, is that they can take some of these principles we're talking about and easily fix and fill those gaps
mm-hmm.
without a lot of effort. They can take it further through building upon those, but you can make a major change just in the simple things that we teach. The second is they ignore the employee in terms of their personal motivation for personal success. So what we have done is said, look, we're going to teach that employee how to fish for their own career success. But the answer to that is, how do they add value to that company's success?
Mm-hmm.
Because if they're trying to build their own success, that is usually to the opposite direction of where they should be going. But if they're trying to help their manager, their team, and the company in line with understanding where the company is going,
mm-hmm.
and then they go and ask for help. They say to a top performer, can you help mentor me? We have a resource, which is a career success and mentoring guide, where the individual goes through the process, answers the questions, goes to that mentor with all the answers that they have come up with personally. All the mentor has to do now is pontificate. Here's my experience. Here's the company, the culture, the politics, the opportunities. And then they have a really intelligent dialogue. It doesn't take a lot of time. Most executives don't mind that level of mentoring.
Right.
But now this employee sees directly from the top executive or whoever their mentor is how they can align themselves with the company and how they can add value. It now is a dialogue. And so the executive also starts to see who this person is. How can I help them? So both sides are helped.
Mm-hmm. So learning more about the individual, obviously, but then also understanding that that if their mindset is company first, and I will benefit when the company benefits, that's kind of like that's the right mixture that makes the most sense.
Which is why we recommend you only hire those people.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a big testing piece that you've got in your process, I would imagine.
Absolutely. That's that assessment I referred to.
Yeah.
But the other key, the third key, is that the executives need help, usually. I call it internal MarCom, where they need help to communicate internally where they're going,
mm-hmm.
what is the business about, what makes us different, what's our competitive advantage, and to stimulate the dialogue of how can we innovate and do better in our industry.
Mm-hmm. So, Jim, if somebody comes in and says, yep, we're going to hire you. This is what we want to do. We want to get this help. What do they go through? What's the first step? Is it the testing is first, or is there a process that you've got that's similar each time, or is it different?
That's why we're called job doctors. So the first thing we do is we evaluate what they want. Mm-hmm. If they want a tactical answer, that's one thing. If they want a strategic overhaul, that's a completely different answer. Our responses are different. The second thing is we then, based on that evaluation, we prescribe which path to take. We then help them to implement that prescription and then have a follow-up. In many cases, it's train the trainer. We simply have a person assigned to us that we work with. They coordinate internally, and then we simply can take them through the process on a tactical basis, bring in other consultants, other coaches as necessary to provide those dimensions that are needed.
So when you're working with these organizations, have you found a good niche? Have you found a size or an industry or a group that you really find works very well in your process?
What we're finding is we're primarily targeting coaches and management consultants. And we have interest right now from Singapore, Sweden, Canada, Boston, and it's growing around the world. And so they're the ones who already have the relationships, the trust with their own clients. It's easier for them to simply add our dimension to what they're already doing to add more value to their clients. Hmm. In Atlanta, I happen to have a lot of friends who are C-level, pardon me, who I've helped, and they're just people I've known for a long time. So for those individuals, we'll come in, we'll assess what they want, we'll try and meet them where they are and help them. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm looking for people best of breed who are the coaches and the consultants that instead of me doing a lot of the tactical work, I'm really best doing what I do and then partnering with others to do best what they do.
Hmm. So the somebody that you'd be looking for is actually those consultants. I mean, that's your primary client.
That's my primary target.
Yeah. Well, great. So tell us a little bit more about how you've developed that business in working with consultants and people that are actually going in and working with the company. Has it been something that's been effective for you through a networking process, or is it just talking to people, or is it mainly the contacts you've already got?
It's primarily networking. People who are on the inside have trusted relationships, and they know who've been successful that they can trust. And those are the ones I want to meet. There are thousands of consultants and coaches out there who could be excellent people. But I will personally spend time with those who have been referred to me by trusted relationships. And based on that, we've even taught individuals how to go through that process themselves, because at the end of the day, business is ultimately relationships and trust. Mm-hmm. Now, on a broader scale, if anyone out in the world wants to partner with us, then we have these standalone solutions that they can take and run with. But in terms of those in Atlanta, with my personal time, I'm seeking for the best of the best, and those are ones that I spend time with.
And what's your vision for this company in the next 5 years, let's say?
5 years, we're expanding the concepts. We're fleshing it out more, adding more value. But we're also going to be creating this best-of-breed network of consultants and coaches worldwide so that as a client has a need, even though their home office may be in Boston, they have offices throughout the world. We'll have a network of people who can then not only take the home office direction, but then help them implement it mm-hmm. on a local basis.
Good stuff. So same as I asked Jim before this, your pearl of wisdom, with the experience that you've had, the people that you've known, the things that you've done, what would your pearl of wisdom be to our listeners?
Well, I'm going to read this just because I believe it's important for word choice.
Okay.
I believe that people have control of their own decisions. So you're either adding value to your team and the company, or you're risking becoming unemployable in a growing global economy. And others are willing to help you. So you have to ask. And if you do ask, they'll be more than happy to help you if you're willing to take it and run. And the second part of that is start with deciding what is your passion, and then ask others to help you to develop that passion by adding value to them. And as you do so, the last point is you need to be sure you're helping others at the same time. And that includes helping others to help you.
All right. Well, perfect. Thank you, Jim. We appreciate you coming out today. If somebody wants to get in contact with you or your business, what's the best way to get in communication with you?
Well, the best way is email, which is jim@jobdoctorsintl.com, or the website's Job Doctors International, fully spelled out, .com, or then call me at 678-485-1687.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. And we will, you going to hang out as well?
Be glad to.
That's great. So our next guest is Bob Drew. And Bob is the president and, I believe, founder of Echo V.
That's correct.
Echo V. And I got it right the second time.
Yeah.
The first time I got it right, and he was very proud of me. And now on air, I did it again. So I'm proud of myself. That's good. Yep. So, Bob, tell us a little bit about your background and a little bit about the company.
Oh, great. Unlike Jim or Jim number one, I'm kind of a slacker. I only have two kids, but I will say that they're twins.
Yeah, so okay. you really are a slacker.
I used to have a friend who had triplets, and he used to say, twins are for sissies. But like Jim, I am an engineer, and I do have an MBA. I started my career and worked for 23 years in corporate America doing a variety of positions, but early in my career, was involved in process engineering. I'm a chemical engineer. Worked in water processes in the paper industry. It was very water intensive, and that's where I got the technical background and know-how to do what I'm doing now. Later on in my career, I went and got my MBA from UCLA, focused on entrepreneurship, and then later on in the corporate career, was involved with innovation, new products, new businesses for the company I was working for. And learned a lot about how to start businesses, worked with a lot of small businesses that we acquired or didn't acquire, and kind of got the bug. And back in 2008, saw an opportunity here in Metro Atlanta for creating a water supply that we don't already have.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by this topic. Come up. I was talking to Nadia. I'll give you a shout out to Nadia for putting this together. And I thought, what a great topic for Atlanta on a rainy day. She timed it perfectly.
Hey, you know what? I was coming down the road. Yeah, there's a little traffic and that, but I had a little bit of a smile on my face.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
the rain's coming.
You know,
down.
Our clients are the same. When it rains, you're saying, "Hey, we're creating our own water supply. We're filling up our tanks. We'll be able to use that for some time to come."
All right, so I got all sorts of crazy questions, but let's start off with Echo V. Tell us about the company and what you guys do.
Well, you know, our mission, as I mentioned before, is really being able to create a new water supply that's done in a better way than maybe our normal municipal supply comes now. Yeah, as we all know, we have challenges with our water supply here in Metro Atlanta. At the same time, it rains a lot here.
Yeah.
So there's ample supply of water falling out of the sky, not just today, but throughout the year, even in a drought. So our real mission is to collect water off of rooftops, filter it, store it, and then distribute it for any use. Probably half of our systems are for outdoor irrigation. Another percentage is for indoor plumbing, toilet flushing, laundry, mm-hmm. other mm-hmm. process uses, maybe industrial uses. And then a smaller percentage, we're actually creating a drinking water supply.
Wow. And this is all collected from the rooftops?
Primarily rooftops, but in some cases, hard surfaces, driveways, parking lots, and that, depending on the end use. That's right.
And I'm sure you get this all the time, but you hear all the new stuff about Lake Lanier and about the Chattahoochee and about all this water war stuff, and you think, man, if they cut us off, we are hosed. We got real problems.
It need not be that way. At least that's my viewpoint.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen in other parts of the world, you take a developed country where rainwater collection has been part of the solution to water supply, where over a course of maybe 10 or 15 years, higher and higher adoption rates occurred. You know, Australia is one country, Germany is another. If you took those adoption rates, applied them to Metro Atlanta, we would be creating a water supply that would rival building a new reservoir.
Really?
And it would be done in a way that wouldn't necessarily reduce downstream flows, which is very interesting. We'd be reducing runoff, reducing flooding, replenishing groundwater supplies, and not affecting what's happening downstream.
Really? Now, why is that? Is it just because when it rains hard, is there just a lot of waste?
There's something to that, but there's a lot of factors. It gets kind of technical, and we waste all the time talking about that. Well, I'll take two things.
Yeah,
one is evaporation. Lake Lanier, a lot of that water just kind of evaporates. If it goes into your cistern or your tank for your rainwater collection, whatever size it is, it doesn't evaporate. The other is that we're having a net effect of replenishing our groundwater supplies, where, say, drilling a well, you're taking out of the ground, we're putting in. And the water communicates between the Chattahoochee River, whatever river, and our groundwater supply. So those are two things.
So what would you say are the major advantages of an ECHO-V system?
Well, first and foremost, as a property owner, our clients are private residences, commercial clients, institutional clients, is reducing your demand on municipal supply. Of course, that means reducing your water bill. You're also reducing runoff. You're solving potential erosion problems on your property. You're providing, for whatever the end use is, a higher quality water, surprisingly. We've done a lot of testing. For our potable clients, the water's cleaner than municipal water, believe it or not. Another effect is if there is a watering ban, you have your water supply, and you can continue watering. So you're protecting your landscaping or your landscape investment.
And I've got a neighbor of mine who drilled a well, and it took forever and whatever, but he's got the well, and it costs a good bit of money to have that done. What's the chances of wells? I mean, do wells dry up? I mean, do you just go deeper, or what's the problem with wells?
Well, the answer is yes. We have seen a number of our clients have come to us with wells, and it's kind of producing less and less, so they need a cistern or augmentation with rainwater collection. And worldwide, in general, we're depleting our groundwater supplies. Wells are fine, I would say, except when you're depleting the groundwater supply. If it's always being kind of topped off by wherever it's coming from, wells are a great supply of water. It's clean, et cetera. But if you're depleting groundwater supply, maybe it's not so good.
Doesn't a well naturally get more water when it rains, or does that not
work? Well, yes, it does. It's just a balance between how much water's coming back in and how much you're taking out. If you're taking out more than you're putting in, that could be a problem. And along the coastlines, I've seen this a lot in some of our clients, you have what's called saltwater intrusion. You drill a well, and if it goes up and down with the tide, that's a sign that maybe you have some problems.
Yeah,
with salt water.
So what's the biggest obstacle you guys have run into in getting this out and getting the message out?
That's it. Getting the message out, it's really about education and understanding, me included. You think about, where does your water come from? Well, it comes out of the tap. Where does it go to after you... After you use it, when you flush it, or it goes down the drain, and that's kind of our mindset. But it's really understanding what the impact of what we do does on the entire hydrological cycle and why it's a benefit or an advantage over other water sources.
Okay, so take some time to educate us. I'm clueless in this area, but okay. You flush it and I figure it goes somewhere. But, and I don't think it's the front or backyard because I don't have So help us
could
understand.
Be.
It could be. Help us understand a little bit better about that whole process and why it's helpful to have a different water source.
Well, okay. Where do we get our water from now? It falls in the ground. In general, it runs along the ground. It picks up pollutants. It goes into a water, a reservoir. In our case, it's surface water, Lake Lanier, Chattahoochee River. So it has some contaminants. Collecting water off the rooftop also has some contaminants, but a lot less than where we get our water from now. And it's a lot easier to treat, and it's a lot easier to keep it clean for your future use. The other benefit is that you don't have to treat to ultimate potable water standards for every single use. If you're going to water your garden, the water's perfect pretty much as is for watering the garden, watering your lawn. If you're using for indoor plumbing, yes, you'll do a little more treatment. That treatment's a little bit easier to do. So there's an advantage. The other side of it is where your water goes to after you're done.
Right.
You're replenishing groundwater supplies, or if you're using the water indoors, it's going through the normal process that it goes through now, which is municipal treatment, back into the river, downstream, and depending where you live, it goes on to the next user who then take it, use it, clean it up, and use it for their uses.
Right, right. So what kind of costs do you deal with when you're trying to set something like this up? What are you doing when you're when does it make sense for somebody, and who does it make sense for?
Well, what we like to do, being, you know, take an engineering approach, is we've built a computer model that will look at actual rainfall day by day for a particular client in their area, and we'll look historically. We'll look at an average rainfall year. We'll look at a high rainfall year, 2009, for example. We'll look at a drought year. 2007 is my favorite for that. And we'll run models with different system sizes, different usages, and we'll work out what makes sense for them. And that all drives into whatever your goals may be. If it's financial payback, we can use it for that. If it's being off the grid, you can see how off the grid you can be. If it's stormwater reduction, it'll tell you that as well. Hmm. So that's our starting point.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of said, where would it make the most sense? Our clients tend to be driven by wanting to do the right thing, thinking long-term in terms of water supply, not necessarily in a two-year payback or something
right.
like that. However, we do see that in places where water rates are extremely high, and that is City of Atlanta.
Yeah.
If you're in City of Atlanta, we're seeing, especially with our commercial clients, pretty decent NPVs or paybacks.
How does the city or the counties, I know they all work differently, but how do they tie that in as an expense? Do they charge you for sewage, or how does that all work?
It's all different, and it all, I come back to education. Our company and others have worked a lot with City of Atlanta to work out. We've recently passed an ordinance to allow private residences to create rainwater systems for potable use. In that case, they do charge a nominal fee for sewer if the water is used indoors. If it's outdoors, there's really no constraint at all. You're reducing your entire flow because you don't put the water
doesn't
back
go
into
the sewer, right?
Yeah.
So, but how would they? Do they know? I mean, how do they know what gets used indoor? Do they have a meter on it?
No,
or something?
No. In that particular case, they are just charging an annual fee based on the size of your tank.
Mm.
Keeping it simple.
And so a rain like today. So you're driving down the highway and you're smiling because you got water coming out the wazoo today, right? This
yep.
is good stuff for you.
Mm-hmm.
This is like this is like profits just coming through off the rain. So would a day like today fill a tank?
Well, yeah, let me get back to that little education thing. You know, I didn't realize, and most of us don't realize, how much water you can collect off a rooftop. Let's just take a 2,000-square-foot house, you know, kind of average. An inch of rain will give you about 1,200 gallons of water. Off a roof, 1 inch.
Wow.
It's rained over an inch so far on this rainstorm, so that's how much water you'd be collecting. You know, for example, I have about 3,000 square feet, 3,000 gallon tank, topped it off already.
Already by the time
I left to come up here.
Wow. So what happens when it tops it off? Does it just automatically just now flow out someplace?
Sure. We design overflows. We design it. We like to design it in such a way that it infiltrates into the ground through bioswales, bioretention, rain gardens, whatever term you like to use.
Mm-hmm. Do you get kind of bummed after your tank's full? Do you know it's full? Or do you know?
Oh, yeah.
You got a meter somewhere that says, I'm full.
Yeah, that's standard.
And it's raining and you're going, ah.
No.
I'm full and it's raining. It's kind of a...
For me, not really, because I run through this computer model and you know it's going to overflow a certain percentage. And that just, one at a time.
Where it goes.
Happy to have it topped off.
Yep. Do you run out much?
You do. Depends on your design. We design for certain things, for certain objectives, but we usually design for a certain percentage of being empty, you know, 10, 20% of the year. There'll be times, you know, if you go 3 weeks without rain, which we did a couple times this summer, we're in a so-called drought. Yeah, you would have been dry a few times.
And are these tanks underground or are they on top or where do they put them?
They're above ground, below ground, could be in a crawl space, could be under a deck. There's all different kinds. Our company, we don't make our own products per se. We look for the best. We're an engineering firm. We look for the best products, design the best solution for our customers.
So I'm a visual guy. Of course, I'm on radio, so it makes lots of sense. But so if give me a measurement. Your tank is, what did you say, 3,000? 3,000 gallons, right? How big is that?
That is about a single 3,000-gallon tank, about 8 feet tall and 8 feet in diameter.
Wow. Yeah. You can't stick that underneath a deck.
Yeah, it's one of the other kind of, well, you could. Some people have really big decks. And we put that size tank under a deck. Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you could. And you bury something that big?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
All the time.
That's a big...
A lot bigger as well. Mm-hmm. You know, a typical residential is probably 3,000 to 5,000 gallons for our clients. Yep. Could be smaller. Commercial, I mean, boy, it could be, you know, over 100,000. Yeah. Yeah, easily.
So if you were, how long would it take you? Give me some kind of an idea of how long it would take to empty, and for what use, a 3,000-gallon tank?
Well, shoot, it depends. Say you're using
watering a yard or something.
Saying you're using that water indoors.
Okay.
A typical family of four uses about 50 gallons a day per person. So it's 200 gallons a day, 15 days.
Okay.
That's how long that would last. Outdoor irrigation depends outside how big your lawn is, how much you use, and all sorts of factors. You could use it up a lot faster than that.
Yeah, because you water the lawn, I would imagine that's using a ton of water.
It does, especially turf. You know, with the rain patterns here in Atlanta, it's great. A lot of parts of the world, you take Phoenix or something, it rains a little bit. It rains all at once. Here it rains about every 10 days. Mm. So if you have a system that lasts about 10 days, you're pretty good. You're pretty much set.
And then when that runs out, I guess it automatically takes, you don't like run out of water, or do you have to like switch?
No, we usually will put in an automatic system that automatically switches you back to city water, so you don't even know it.
Good.
Except
good.
Your water quality might drop a little.
doesn't taste as good. You drink. You say you can set it up for drinking.
Yes, we've personally done about four potable water systems, and it's very common in other parts of the world, other parts of the U.S.
Why so few here? Is it just a cost piece that it's harder?
You know, we've done a couple here in Metro Atlanta, really driven by. People that wanted to be off the grid and wanted better water quality and were willing to pay for it. We had another client down in St. Croix, Virgin Islands, put in a big 30,000-gallon system with very high-end treatment for a home. And why did they do it? It made sense financially because they didn't have any other water source. They had drilled a well, had saltwater intrusion. It was either trucking it in or doing this, so they did this. And rainwater collection is... very common down there.
Yeah, because it rains all the time.
Well, yeah.
I mean, well, I guess it's got
more
seasons.
Of a dry season, yeah, wet seasons. Season compared to here.
So, what kind of clients have you found? People that you found that decide to move forward with this. You talked about people that have the conservation and people that are kind of mindsetted on that. In Atlanta, what kind of individuals are saying, yeah, let's do this?
Yeah. On the commercial side, it tends to be people with high water usage and high water bills. And there's a couple segments we're looking at very heavily that seem to be very interesting. Restaurant chains. Very high water usage, especially for toilet flushing, some grounds watering, and if we can have the permitting for dishwashing as well, it's really a financial story, along with the whole sustainable story.
How about like golf courses? Have you ever had any golf courses?
Yeah, that comes up a lot. There may be, our solution is more around having the right rooftop size compared to your usage. Mm-hmm. So the type of solution you would develop for a golf course would be a little bit different than what I've been talking about here.
Yeah.
But we may see that as an opportunity. We have started to look at that in terms of bringing in different solutions for providing water for golf courses.
Yeah, I mean, I you go and play in, like, I don't know, the desert, Arizona or Hawaii or something, you're thinking, where in the world is the water? You know, obviously, they're mm-hmm. pulling it from the ocean and
yeah.
treating it or what have you. But
yeah.
All right, well, that's great stuff, Bob. We appreciate you coming on. And again, your pearl of wisdom. What would your pearl of wisdom be for our listeners?
Boy, I would really encourage everybody to think about and try to understand where your water comes from and where your water's going to. And if you have any need for help in thinking about that, contact us.
And how would people get in contact with you? What's the best way?
The best way is our website, which is ecovirain.com. ecovie.rain.com. Or contact me directly at 404-824-9266.
Okay. Well, Bob, I appreciate your time. Thank you for coming on. And to all our guests, thank you guys for coming on. We are right at the top of the hour, so we will say goodbye. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. And we will hopefully see you or meet you again next week. Same time, same place. Be safe.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA. SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation.